welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
That's called the San Francisco Shuffle by Lux Lewis, one of the less cliched pieces of music dedicated to the fabulous city in California. It's known for culture, for radical politics, for IT with Silicon Valley just across the bay, for beautiful buildings up on the hills, for massive earthquakes, and for science. Hello again, Robin Williams, with a conversation from San Francisco, where you have University of California, Berkeley, Stanford University, just a short drive south, the renowned Academy of Natural Sciences, which is really a museum, and of course the University of California, San Francisco itself. And that's where I met Professor Elizabeth Blackburn. She's from Tasmania, went to Cambridge, and is now a professor at the new campus of University of California, San Francisco. Now I must say that Elizabeth Blackburn has won so many of the top prizes available in medical research, it's inevitable that we have to ask, what about the Nobel? Last year alone, she won the Gruber Prize and the Lasker, both enormously regarded, and before that she scored the Australia Prize as well. So my first comment, as we sit in the sunny park with surreal sculptures outside her gleaming research lab, is, how do you react to all those accolades?
Oh, I was very excited by the recognition, and especially the fact that the work itself was considered of interest and worth recognising, and that was really gratifying.
The work itself is often associated with telomeres. Could you, for the innocent bystander, sum up what a telomere is and what it does?
If you imagine the end of your shoelace, if you happen to not have Velcro, but rather shoelaces keeping your shoes on, think of a shoelace as the chromosome, which is where the genetic information is carried. If you don't protect the ends of the shoelaces, they'll fray away. And by analogy, the telomere is a little bit like the tip at the end of the shoelace. It protects the shoelace, or in this case, the genetic material, from fraying away from the ends. And in fact, without a telomere, a chromosome is in great danger of being lost or rearranged or becoming unstable. And that kind of instability can lead to cancer and can lead to various kinds of diseases we're now finding.
The instability is kind of associated with aging, is it?
There's really two kinds of instability. One kind of instability is as the ends wear down, which is what they do as a natural process of how chromosome DNAs are maintained, unless there's something to counteract it, and we'll talk about that, I hope. But in aging, our chromosome ends do wear down, and what happens is that makes a cell decide it won't self-renew. And so certain diseases in aging is because certain kinds of cells don't self-renew properly. So we're seeing more and more a direct causal relationship, in fact, in some of the very common diseases of aging, including now cardiovascular disease, as well as diabetes and cancer. And we're seeing a connection between this inability to maintain an intact cap on the ends of chromosomes and these diseases, now in human studies.
Let me ask you about this rather broad word, stress. Stress can be all sorts of things, but you'll probably define it for me properly. But it's been associated with this kind of effect, a sort of shortening of telomeres and their function.
Yes, and we were the ones who made the association, in fact. And we and our collaborators here at UCSF, primarily my colleague in the Department of Psychiatry, Alyssa Eppel, who is the clinical psychology researcher, who does very controlled studies on cohorts of people to study the effects of chronic uncontrollable stress situations on individuals. So, Robin, you're asking about stress, and you're absolutely right. There's all sorts of good stress. I just came back from the gym, and believe me, I stressed my body, and I'm incredibly happy. And so this is stress where you rise to a challenge, you control it, and that's something that we're evolved to do very well. You know, the zebra runs away from the lion and so forth. So we can do all that kind of acute reaction to stress and acute stress situations very, very well. But what happens is that in the long term, if the stress situation is something that the individual sees always as a threat or continues to see threatening rather than challenging situations, doesn't identify resources to cope, etc., etc. That's the kind of stress that been long known to have clear clinical outcomes, which are poor outcomes. So that's been known from a number of studies for a number of years. But the part of the puzzle that we added in was that we said, well, let's just look at aging of cells, right at the heart of the cell's decision to renew or not. And that's the decision that a cell makes based on many things. But one of them is whether it feels its genetic material is at risk. And if the telomeres run down, the cell will stop operations and will not self-renew. So we looked and said, does the running down of the telomeres with aging have any relationship to stress? And we found in one case a causal direction that the chronic stress was, we think, causally related to the telomeres running down. In other words, the longer the number of years a person was under an objective stressor, and this was very well defined, this life situation studied, the more years the person was under the stress, the worse was their shortening of their telomeres over and above what normally would happen just in the natural course of aging. So that to us was very interesting because it said somehow chronic stress is having effects on the brain, which we clearly know, which is having effects on physiology in all sorts of ways. And one end result of that is that the telomeres are running down and our cells are losing ability to renew.
Actually affecting the cells, was it all cells or some of the cells or what?
The cells that we looked at were the ones that, you know, people who don't have a disease don't give you their cells lightly, and they shouldn't, but they will very kindly give you blood. And so we looked at initially classes of white blood cells, and we've now broken it down into different subtypes and so forth. But the initial study was just with white blood cells, which are kind of a window into your immune system. It tells you about, especially if you start to break it down into the different subtypes, that's what we're doing now, that can give you a really good window into whether your immune system is working well, inappropriately, having inflammatory type responses, getting exhausted, etc. And so that's what we're seeing now in more detailed studies with other cohorts. These kinds of things are going on in the immune system. Now, immune system function and inappropriate inflammatory responses have also been related more and more to cardiac disease risk. And so an interesting thing in our study was that we found that the enzyme telomerase, which replenishes chromosome ends and counteracts that wearing down, when we looked at telomerase in these normal cells of the body, these are completely normal, they're not cancerous, when we looked at telomerase, we found that it was also lower the worse the chronic stress in quantifiable ways. And then we found that in the individuals in our first cohort, there was lower telomerase in individuals who had more of the six cardiovascular disease risk factors, which are the major ones: smoking, poor lipid profile, poor cardiac reactivity under stress, diabetes or risk factors in for diabetes, and of course chronic psychological stress, as well as adiposity. All of those went with low telomerase in the blood cells. So we think we're getting a kind of a window into what's going on in cells. And fascinatingly, the one parameter that always tied with these six major factors for cardiovascular disease was lower telomerase. So that doesn't tell you how it works. It just says it's a sign that there's something going on in all of those major six risk factor areas.
Telomerase being the enzyme, of course. And what about the psychological association? We mentioned stress and you gave a list of some of the physical maladies, if you like. But what were these people doing? Working shift work doing what?
Yes, the particular things that we've looked at in, first of all, the cohort we've published, and now in a cohort we are in the middle of studying. And the first cohort was mothers who were the primary caregiver for their biological child who had a chronic disease of one kind or another. It actually didn't matter what the chronic disease was for the purposes of this study. And the mothers had been in this situation for times that range from 1 to 12 years in our cohort. As you can well imagine, that's an inherently stressful situation for the mother to be in. And other quantifiable parameters were looked at in this cohort, such as their levels of perceived stress. And in psychology, there are criteria which used and which have good clinical prediction outputs, and so they look like they're good measures of what's called perceived stress. How do you feel about this situation? As you can imagine, you know, a mother who is in this situation, you know, there'll be variation in how they perceive this and how they're coping and so forth. So we looked at those two and took them both as independent parameters and also, you know, related parameters, and looked at them very carefully, and each of them were related. The number of years of chronic stress and the perception of the stress were all related to the lowered telomerase, which will be the thing that leads to the quicker wearing away of the telomeres. The other cohort we're looking at now, and this is all in progress, is another group of caregivers, much older. They're women whose husband is a dementia patient, often Alzheimer's, and they are the primary caregiver for that individual. Again, they've had years of being in this setting, and we're now adding in depression as well as clinical depression symptoms into our analyses. And again, it's in progress, but we're certainly seeing the same trends that we saw with the first cohort.
Yes. So it's a window on the body and how it's responding to this, but you mentioned counteraction, because some relief when you feel this overwhelming effect, the aging effect on your very, very cells, there is a way to counteract?
Well, we have the enzyme telomerase, and so that's our natural counteractor. And so now, of course, the question is, can we in any way, you know, use stress intervention kinds of actions to try to make telomerase a little more active? You know, part of the way one would approach the problem would be, you know, to try to look for the magic pill that activates telomerase. And certainly that would be something to try to do. But in the meantime, are there ways that you can use proven stress intervention methods? And again, I think that, you know, this is something really worth looking at. And we're now engaged in studies where there are very active, controlled clinical studies to try to do just that. And so we don't know the answers yet. We know that such interventions can reduce some of the stress parameters and some of the physiological parameters. Whether this particular one will also be modulated, we don't know. But we would certainly love to find out. And, yes, and that's what we're doing. So we know what happens from, you know, normal, whatever normal is, down through the bad range. And now we'd like to see, well, what happens now as you go in the other direction toward the improvement range? You know, is this going to be something that's modulated? Or is normal as good as it ever gets and it can't make it any better? We just don't know the dynamic range of this. So, of course, you know, we live in hope and we always hope that we can improve things. But to be honest, we have not tested what the range is. We just know as you go in the bad direction, things get worse, but we don't know how much better you can go in the good direction.
If there's more telomerase, am I right in thinking that there'd be more normal cell division and renewal of tissues, or what?
Yes, a lot of much of our body is renewing all the time. You know, our immune system is the most active renewer of all and pumps out countless billions of cells throughout our lifetime in the process of carrying out its function of warding off infections. But also, the immune system has to be very carefully regulated so it doesn't have inappropriate inflammatory responses. And so as things get out of whack, then that's one of the things that has been tied more and more to cardiovascular disease risk, certain kinds of cardiovascular disease risk, as the immune system has more inappropriate sort of inflammatory reactions. So that's an interesting tie-in, and we don't know how that relates to our finding of the cardiovascular disease risk tie-in with low telomerase in white blood cells, that window on the immune system. But we do know that there are rare individuals with a genetic disease, and now there are quite a few families who've been found around the world, and they're lacking a gene for telomerase RNA. That's part of the telomerase enzyme. But they don't completely lack telomerase. They only have half the gene dosage. And what happens is that in these individuals, they die of progressive bone marrow failure and looks like their stem cells just get exhausted sometime in their life. And so they never make it to old age. these afflicted individuals. And so the immune system is the clinically most important system that gets exhausted through insufficient telomerase in these individuals. And that has been really well established through multiple families. Now, there are also other self-renewing tissues and cells that you can also see are not able to renew properly. So hair gets grey and skin gets a little abnormal and things like that. But it's the immune system that's the first to go in people who don't have enough telomerase because of this genetic accident. But that's rare. And so now we're interested in the range for, you know, the great majority of people. If 50% is bad for a gene dosage compared with 100% normal gene dosage, you know, what's it like if you're in the 70, 80, 90% range? Is it going to have any effects on the ability of your body to keep renewing through the very long lifespan? You know, we're talking about decades and decades of adult life here. So these effects could be subtle, but cumulatively over decades, they really add up.
When you crack it, it'll be a really big deal, won't it?
Well, it looks fairly cracked now, I have to say. I mean, we found these things a couple of years ago, and the studies that have now emerged in lots of other cohorts have been to look at telomere length, which is an output of telomerase activity, and easier to measure than telomerase itself. And many cohorts are seeing clear relationships between excessively shortened telomeres and the kinds of things I was talking about, you know, things that predispose to diabetes, diabetes itself, things that predispose to cardiovascular disease, also cardiovascular disease incidence. It's showing up more and more in all sorts of cohorts, which is great because, you know, you do your own work in one carefully controlled cohort or two, and you want to make sure, you know, is it just a freak of your cohort or something like that? So it's really reassuring in sort of, I suppose, an informative way. At least it's reassuring that the same thing is really showing up a great deal in many different cohorts now. You know, every month or so you see a new study coming out, all pointing in that direction. So we would just love to know how it works, because if we can see how it works, then we can try and see if there's something useful that can be done about it. But we have to understand it first.
A couple of little personal questions as you're here, having just been for exercise. The surroundings in the sun, and you know, it's supposed to be midwinter, but in Northern California, where it was San Francisco, it's like a spring day. We're surrounded by flowers. The university.
Magnolias,
yes, you've got a new campus. It's fabulous here, isn't it?
It's very energizing, yes, because it feels very spacious. I have a postdoc from Iowa, which you remember is, you know, the big, wide, open cornfields. And so he said, when we'd moved down here a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, it really reminds me of Iowa. And I looked around at this very gritty, urban sort of very, you know, industrial landscape, which it especially was then. And I said, Iowa, he said, it's so spacious, right? And I realized I like that because, you know, in Australia you have this spacious feeling. So I think I like it because of that.
You miss Australia?
Well, we try and go back as often as possible. And these days we manage to get back, you know, once a year or so. All my family is in Australia, so, and I have a new nephew born in November. So, you know, we try and go back as often as we possibly can.
You had differences with Washington last year, with President Bush and the committee you were on. Could you give me a rough idea of what the difficulties were?
Oh, what you're referring to was the Federal Commission, which in this case was called the President's, and is called the President's Council on Bioethics. And so it was founded in the beginning of 2002, and we were appointed for two-year terms on this to advise on various bioethics issues, but including a hot-button issue at the time, which was cloning and human embryonic stem cell research. And so I agreed to go on this council because I thought, well, as a cell biologist and scientist, I can at least assess information, and I'm not somebody who's directly working on embryonic stem cells or adult stem cells myself, so I can speak with a somewhat more distant viewpoint than if I were immersed in that research, but I'm certainly close enough to it in the kinds of cell and molecular biology I do. Anyway, so went on this council and kept saying, got to get the science right when you write reports, and fell into disagreement with whatever sort of goal there was in the reports that this committee was putting out, because I kept arguing the science was not being presented in a balanced way. And so after serving on the council for 2 years, then the White House called and said, you know, thank you, but you're not on it anymore. So, and interestingly enough, people said, oh, have you lost a job? And I kept saying, well, you know, I have a day job, actually. You know, I'm a scientist. Right? It was another committee, but it caused a huge amount of interest because I think it was a very specific example of a much more broadly worrying thing that had, you know, really been a broad concern, which was science policy being influenced by things that weren't based on scientific evidence.
Ideology.
Among other things, or not taking the evidence into account. And I think that while I had no illusions going into this council about the fact that, of course, it was immersed in a political environment, and of course one wouldn't, you know, not be having to consider these things as the policy was being determined, it was surprising to me that even the science itself was not immune from these influences. And I think as scientists, it sort of sticks in our throats when the evidence is being ignored. Because my feeling is evidence, that's what you take, and then you try and craft policy from that. And so to try and, you know, mess with the evidence even, to me, was quite surprising. Or bias the evidence, not mess with it, but bias it and present it. And this is for something where if you're setting policy, it seems like there's a responsibility to get the evidence as good as you can, even though it's hard sometimes in a shifting field where the science moves quickly. It's a somewhat moving target, but you try your best to, you know, be as balanced as possible as to what the situation really is.
There's a book called The Republican War on Science, in which you're mentioned by Chris Mooney. War on Science kind of says it rather starkly. Do you think it's a fair title to what has been called a fact-free policy?
Well, you know, titles are titles, and certainly reading what was said about the things that I knew about from first person, they were accurate. So, yep, and it certainly looked as though war on science mightn't be too strong a term, and we shouldn't laugh. It's actually pretty concerning, I would say, because, you know, science is clearly a big part of what happens in society, and so we do need to at least take into account what are the realities and what are the possibilities and what are the, you know, danger points in a way that can inform policy in a responsible kind of way.
2007 is not the time to take that risk, is it, to get the science wrong?
I don't think it was ever time to take the risk, but now I think you're alluding to ideas that global warming and a lot of very serious sorts of challenges are here, and, you know, we have to be really, really thinking about them very hard. And in a way, I would love to see much more of a public and, you know, international debate on this, because, you know, I'm at a university and we have the most wonderful students. They are just really, really so excited about science. They love science. They do it so well and so forth. And, you know, there's all this incredible talent that should be harnessed into dealing with big problems that the world has. And these are very idealistic. Young people are idealistic and they're smart and they have lots of really good contributions to be made. And I would just love to see somehow that that could be put to good use, because there's no shortage of will and interest in these kinds of big questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Blackburn in San Francisco. She is the winner last year of the Lasker Prize and the Gruber Prize, and also a winner of the Australia Prize back in 1998. She's the most fancied Australian now in the running for the Nobel Prize, but her staff won that said very quietly so we don't jinx her prospects. Well, next week at this time, I shall introduce Michelle Field and her conversationalist, Oliver James, whose book Affluenza is now number 7 in the Sunday Times of London bestseller list. Not to be confused with Affluenza by our own Clive Hamilton, though I suspect they agree on a few points. Here's a taste.
In 97, I wrote a book that was suggesting that there was a lot of evidence that we're considerably more mentally ill than we were in the 1950s, despite being much richer. And I guess that's become even more significant 10 years later, in that there's a lot of scientific evidence now that we really are considerably worse off, and it is particularly since the 80s that it's got worse. So the agenda, I guess, of people like me and the Happiness Forum is very much to encourage people to think again about what you're doing with your lives. Wake up and smell the coffee. You know, on their deathbed, nobody says, I wish I'd spent more time in the office, and Australia has the highest working hours anywhere in the developed world.
Oliver James, who's a psychologist, next week at this time in conversation, talking about affluenza. And you can join me again on ABC Radio National for The Science Show at 10 past 12 on Saturday, when we go to Titan, one of the big moons of Saturn, and try to land, well, sometime in advance in 2013, on a far distant asteroid. I'm Robin Williams, and this is the San Francisco Shuffle.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.